anonymous, you know, Tanakama over here. He says Tanakama means, you know, the first authority. Okay, and very often in Tanakama may be somebody who is mentioned by name, but very often Tanakama is simply anonymous, as in this particular case. Okay, so the Tanakama, whoever he may be, God bless him, it says it makes no difference whether this chamber pot is standing in front of the bed or it's behind the bed. If you don't say Krishna facing it, okay? So, yeah, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel lo mer, however, Rabbi Shimon says, Le'achar hamito, if the pot is there behind the bed, then korei, then he is permitted to recite Krishna. But lifnei hamita, if it's standing in front of the bed, I mean, he's facing it, right, then ain't a korei. He is not allowed to read it. Abul marchiku arba amos v'korei. But he has to move himself for amos, and then he reads. I mean, this is as we learned before, okay? All right.
This is whether it's empty or full.
Yeah.
Or is it?
Well, obviously, look, let's put it this way. While Rashi seems to indicate that if you simply took something... once you've actually used it for urine,
it's contaminated.
So it's contaminated, right? So you shouldn't do it. Okay, even if you added water to it, strictly speaking, you shouldn't be doing it.
Right.
Okay. I mean, this is the way we pass them today.
Okay.
Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, now this is a different Shimon. The first one was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who said that behind the bed, it's okay, but in front of the bed you don't, but you have to remove yourself. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Amer, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, afilu bayis meyo amoy, he says, even a house which is 100 amos, in other words, a, what shall we say, 400 feet in length, he says, lo yikra achir tziyem oshan yichem tachas hamito. He's not allowed to recite Krishna in this. Now, of course, I mistranslated the word bias. I did it purposely. But the simple reason that, while to us, bias normally means what?
House.
A house. But in the Gemara, very often, bias does not mean a house. It means a room. Right. Okay. So, in other words, what he's really saying over here is not a house, which is 400 feet long. But what he's saying is, I don't mean 400 feet, but let's see, 400 inches, 40 inches times 100? That's 4,000. That would be 4,000, yeah. 4,000 inches. Okay, anyway, that's a lot. It's
4,000 inches divided by 12 would be like...
Right.
Like
so what he's saying, if you're in a room, let's say, which would be this length, okay?
Can you give me the two translations of Meir
sure.
Amor?
An Amor is approximately 18 inches.
A cubit,
right. But there are others who say that it's 24 inches.
Yes.
So it's anywhere between 18 and 24, okay? All right. So he says, even if you have a room which has 100 Amos, all right, so that would be
150.
Yeah, that would be 1800 or maybe 2400 inches. Okay, so divide it. All right, let's say 2400 inches. Okay,
2400.
It's 200 feet.
Right, divided by 12. Right. Okay, so I mean that's a room that's much bigger than this. But the point that he's making is that even in the biggest room that there is, if you have a chamber pot in it, don't say Krishna. Even though it's, you know, after all, we said four amos you remove yourself from it, right? And he says, even if the whole thing is 100 amos long, if there is a chamber pot in there, then you don't say Krishna. Yes.
Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that if it's you know, it's in front, it's not.
If it's in front,
it's
you can't
good.
Do it. Right.
And it's behind the bed, it's okay.
Right.
But he said you have to remove yourself four amos.
Right.
Does that mean that then you can say Krishna?
Yes. That's what he means.
That's what he means.
Right.
Okay. I wasn't aware of that.
It's not 100% clear exactly what he means. This we
Why then move four amos?
But obviously you have to remove yourself for Ramos no matter where you are, okay? Even if it's permitted.
Even if it's permitted.
Even if it's permitted, his implication would be that you still don't do it right on top of the bed, but you have to remove yourself. And then let's say it's beyond, you know, on the other side of the bed.
But he's not clear as to whether it means four amos from behind the bed or in front of the bed.
Okay. No, I
would it be from the bed or from the
It would be in front of the bed, obviously. He's not going to go to the back of the bed and go to the sacred.
Yeah.
But you're measuring, from the pot, not from the bed.
The pot, yeah.
No, that's the whole point. See,
I think that the implication over here is that he has to be four amos away from the bed before he does.
Bed would have, four amos would be 6 feet.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Let's see, 18 inches, 1 foot, okay.
Yeah, right.
6 feet. So,
well, they didn't
that would, there would be no necessity then to say four amos because you would already be four amos. So if they say four amos.
No, your bed isn't 6 feet.
Well, okay. Wait a second. Let me just. I'm sorry. I'm on a roll here.
He's on a roll.
I'm on a roll here. Then he can destroy me.
No.
If they went to the trouble of saying four amos, then it must be to do an additional four amos to go back six more feet. So that you, in effect, will be 12 feet from where the chamber pot was.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But you could be standing. You could be standing 6 feet from a chamber pot and still be standing on the other side of the bed from it, just a foot or two away from the bed, depending on what size bed you're talking about.
So why would they bother to say four amos?
That's what I'm asking.
What would be the proof? It would be superfluous.
Obviously, we have to sort of, you know, work it out over here. If he's saying remove yourself four amos from the chamber pot, then he doesn't mean and stand facing it either. I mean,
obviously,
this is obviously right. First of all, what's behind? He said, okay, forget about that because it's covered over. You can't see.
And he doesn't. And he still has to move four amos.
But you should move four amos maybe away from the bed, behind which there is
a chamber pot.
That's one interpretation. The other interpretation may be that you cannot stand, you know, where there is a chamber pot in front. So, what are you going to do? Can you stand, let's say, four amos away from the chamber pot, or from maybe from the kli that we said, you know, in other words, you take some other vessel, a jar off the shelf,
whatever,
and you know, you put it in. So, according to one implication, it may be that you are permitted to do it. If you remove yourself a sufficient distance from it, right? And yet, when the statement was made, you know, that even a room of 100 amos, there the implication is very clear that if the chamber pot is there in the open, even if you removed yourself 100 amos from it within that room, it's not the kind of a room in which you're permitted to recite Krishna.
But if it's a glass chamber pot, you're allowed to.
Well, that according to Tosfos. Rashi doesn't really hint upon it, okay? Rashi doesn't really, I mean, Tosfos implies that Rashi is making that distinction. But it was Tosfos that brought up the business about glass.
Okay.
Of course, this whole business about balua and glass, I mean, you realize that it has more implications than simply whether it's used as a container for urine. This is already part of the whole problem about dishes.
Uh-huh.
Why do we say, you know, that, for example, you know, that let's say clay cheres, if you have earthenware dishes, that you cannot kasher them, you know, it becomes stray if you throw it out. Why? Because of the implication of balua, the fact that
it
by its nature it absorbs.
But yet you can use glass for both milk and clay.
All right. There is an opinion that permits the use of glass, so I have to tell you, most of the poskim did not permit it, okay? Because, for various reasons, possibly they have a feeling that maybe it could also absorb. That's opinion number one, but opinion number two is even stronger. If you permit the indiscriminate use of glass dishes for both mechliks and fleishiks, then in that case, what will people be saying?
Saying you're a trade.
Or the other implication that you can any dish, you can use Bilkins and Fleishiks, you know, and then not worry about making a separation between them.
It's appearances.
Right. So they don't mean tacha, they mean tachar. You know,
tachar means behind. Tachas, right. We didn't discuss
under,
it.
Under. Tachas is under, right?
Tachas is under. We didn't discuss that yet.
Okay.
We're coming to that.
Today. Okay, excuse me. Go ahead.
See, your minds are working 100%. You're anticipating every problem that we're having.
I'm waiting to see over the chair.
Okay.
All right.
So getting Robin, back again Robin to these two statements. Oh, yeah. All right. So far we have the following statement. Okay. Rabbi Shimon Yadiel says the Achar Amita Korei, right?
Yeah,
he's permitted to read
that,
if it's behind. Lifnei Amita Eino Korei, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's in front of the bed, he cannot. Avol Marchiku Arba Amos V'Korei, but he is permitted to step 4 amos away from this. Probably the chamber pot is really the best way to understand it. But mm-hmm. you know, go 4 chveis, go to another end of the room, in other words, so that you're not facing it, and then you are permitted to do it, right?
Wait a second, I got this completely backwards. In other words, the 4 amos,
the most logical one actually is 4 amos away from the chamber pot.
From the one that's lifnei hamita.
Right.
From before.
Oh.
This makes the best sense of all. Okay. The reason why I'm a little bit hesitant is because they're not 100% sure either how to understand.
Hmm.
As we'll see. Okay?
Okay.
But this is what's happening. Okay? But the most logical one is the last interpretation that I gave you. Namely, that if you have this chamber pot in front of the bed, you cannot say Krishna facing it, but if you go, let's say, 4 amos away in another direction or something like that, so that you're not facing it, then in that case it would be permissible, right? Yeah.
According to
Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Right. So now along comes Rabbi Shimon Elazar, and what does he say? He says, Apilu bais meya amo, even in a room which is 100 cubits in length. Right, lo yikra, he's not allowed to recite Krishna over there, Asha Yotziyem, until he takes out this pot, takes it out of the room altogether. O sheyanichem tachas amito, or he takes this chamber pot and he puts it underneath the bed. Okay, now obviously underneath the bed, no. So iboiluhu, so they ask the following question, now that they brought this up, it says, Echi ko omar. What did he mean when he said Achar Hamito Kore Miyad Lifnei Hamito Marchik Abba Amos V'Kore? Does it mean, he says, that if the chamber pot is behind the bed, then he's immediately permitted to read Krishna? Why? He's not seeing it, right? It's hidden away, and therefore he can say Krishna. Whereas Lifnei Amito, if it is in front of the bed, right, then Marchik Arba Amos Bekore, and he steps, you know, 4 amos to the side, and he reads. Is that the way we understand it? Or Dilmo, or perhaps Hochi Koma. Maybe this is what he said. La'achar Hamito, if it is behind the bed, then Marchik David Amos Bekore. Then, you see, that's why I said we didn't decide it yet.
Right,
so in that case, still you have to step away
Dalet
Amos from the bed. You don't do it right on top of the bed, but you have to distance yourself from the bed by at least 4 Amos. And then you read, even though, where is the chamber pot?
In back of
the It's
bed.
In back, right, where you can't even see it. But still, you know, you would be required to do this. Whereas Lifnei Hamito, if it's in front of the bed, then in a correct cloud, and in that case, you're not allowed to read, period.
At all.
Yeah, at all.
So what if we see a very bright group here, we went through all the common
right.
without reading ahead.
This is what I'm saying. I mean, we're very bright. We're really hitting all cylinders, you know.
it's the weather.
So they say, Toshba. Okay, listen, they say. The Tanya. We have learned another statement. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, what? Achar hamito, that behind the bed, korei miyad, as long as it's behind the bed, he's permitted to read immediately. And lifnei hamito, and if it is in front of the bed, then marchig arba amos, right? Then he has to remove himself 4 amos. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, "Afilu b'ayis meyer amo lo yikra asher yotziyem." Oshanichem tachas hamita, right?
It repeats it.
Right. But though, you notice what is different about
the... They reverse the names.
Very good, David.
They reverse the names.
Exactly what it is. Yeah, here is our new problem now.
They reverse the names.
They're making the same statements, but now they reverse the author's names.
Oh, my God. It's a type of grammatical error.
Well, we don't know. So they say, Bayan Nivshipalon. So he says, you know, the problem that we started with, this we understand. Namely what? That if it's achar hamita, if it's behind the bed, then you're permitted to read, period, right? Whereas if it's lifnei hamita, then you can't read unless you are
dalet
amos. But of course, what was the extreme opinion that we heard?
100 amos.
Even 100 amos you don't, unless you take it out,
right?
Okay, or you hide it underneath the bed, he said. Okay. But he says, masniyasa kashin ahadari. But you know, these two traditions that we've cited, they contradict each other. So he says, ipuch bas raisa. So he says, okay, you know what? Change the names in the last statement that we read. In other words, instead of Shimon ben Gamliel and Shimon ben Elazar, make it Shimon ben Elazar and Shimon ben Gamliel. Okay, guns fine. So he says, maichad zis de pachta bas raisa. So he says, hey, what business do you have saying, you know, that you should change the names in the last statement? Ipuch kamaiso. Maybe we should instead change the names of the authority in the first statement that we quoted. Bas Raisa really means the last over here, and, you know, kamaiso means the first statement. Okay? So he says, Man Shamat Lei says, okay, let's try to figure this one out. All right. Who do you follow? The Omar Kulei Bayis Ka'arba Amos Domi. Who is the authority who said that the entire room is like Arba Amos? In other words, it's like one domain. This is what he means. Because Arba Amos is the minimum of a private domain. Okay? You're 6 feet, okay? You're 6 feet. The Yalla Dalla.
So who is the...
There are many, many rules to which this business of Arbama applies. I'll just give you one. If you're in the street, okay, the Dalet Amos where you are standing, that is your own private domain. Beyond that, it is already not. Therefore, technically, let's say if you drop something in the Arba Amos, you're allowed to pick it up. Say technically, provided that you stand still, you pick it up.
Someone
but
else
pardon me.
Someone else
someone's faster than you. Don't have to worry about that. No shayla anymore.
Does this apply during the week or?
I'm talking about Shabbos.
Oh, you're talking about Shabbos. I think it's okay.
But in Shabbos, you have the rule of Arba Amos.
Okay.
In other words, your own private domain consists of Dalet Amos. Beyond that, it's already other domains. Okay, public domain, whatever it may be. Understand? And of course, we're not allowed to carry beyond Dalet Amos in our own private domain.
Right.
Okay?
Presumably this is a circle radius Arba Amos.
Yeah, correct.
You mean you can't, even if you're in your own home, you can't carry more than Dalet Amos?
In your own home, you have the entire home as your own private domain.
All right, okay.
But what would be the minimum amount of space that would be considered a private domain? I mean, let's say you're so poor that you can only afford, let's say, three amos, and that's it. I don't know how you could live in it.
But if you were
you live in a broom closet or something, I don't know.
Lay down.
All right. So that is not considered a private domain. It becomes private domain once it is dalet amos, okay? Because the minimum for a house, bias, which I'm using now in the sense of room, not home, right, would be dalet amos.
Okay.
So, as I say, there are many halachas that depend upon this Arba Amos. For example, a Kohen technically might be permitted to go on the cemetery, although he should not. But technically he could be permitted to go if he were always at a distance of how much? Arba Amos, right, away from the nearest grave. Yeah. That's the minimum. Others say that's a little bit more than that. It depends upon whether you consider Amo 18 inches, or do you consider it maybe 24 inches or something like that, you see? There are differences of opinion as to the exact length of an amma.
I unfortunately just started thinking of putting it underneath, so that we need to be 6 feet above things. I mean, you know, this 6 feet under is a Western thing.
The idea of the arba amos actually applies to a mess also.
How
person who has passed away, we say that the burial plot is his own private
domain.
Dalit amos, that's his private domain.
Well, we're talking about, a radius?
Could be a radius or it could be in the square, either way.
But even in a square, you're talking about 3 feet this way, 3 feet that way, 3 feet that way, 3 feet that way. No grave that I have ever seen has that much room. It's one right next to the other.
Correct.
But,
nevertheless, we're talking about six feet down. Yeah. When we talk about 6 feet down, I mean, of course, that means that the length, right, of the minimum amount of space that the burial should take place.
Far much space down.
Right, right. But nevertheless, even around, we say that the mess is entitled to his dalit amos. Right, he is entitled to it. Okay? Now, what you said is correct. I mean, that in our cemeteries, we don't really pay attention to that rule. Okay? Because where space is at a premium, then you have to utilize as much as you possibly can.
One of the Leviathans I went to New York, where part of the grave was dug out about this much, maybe a foot and a half or so, underneath the road we were standing on.
Yeah.
So you had to get it in like this.
Yeah, oh boy.
Needless to say, no coin would be permitted to walk over there. Because, right.
I don't think of any. Yeah. I can't think of any unless it's one of these huge ones where they have vocal room between.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
None of them that I've been on will give you 6 feet.
Yeah, now for example, the Kadima Cemetery, I mean, the roadway, if you stood right in the middle, I don't know. I never really measured it.
I got it.
I was just trying to think, but it is
very narrow.
Yeah,
right.
The roadway is narrow enough, so I guess it wouldn't work. You're right.
I don't think you'd leave 6 feet, you're right.
But, you know, there are areas within the Kadima Cemetery where no body has been buried as yet.
Yeah.
So there, I mean, you might technically allow a coin to stand, you know, as long as he's at least 4 amas from the nearest grave. But as I say, that's a technicality. As a real rule, a coin does not go to the Beis HaKvaros unless he's one of the Kohanim who doesn't give a darn about being a coin, and he disregards everything else too.
Before we return to this, could you just define the depth of a grave? What a grave?
Yeah.
How deep must it be?
It should be 6 feet, I would say, 6 to 8 feet.
Ideally 6 feet of cover.
Right, ideally. Again, I don't sit down and I measure it, you know.
Remember,
too, you see, that the way we bury them, they used to bury them right in the ground. And that's the way it's done still in many, many communities. That, they simply wrap them in the tachrichim. And in Europe, and even in Eretz Israel, in certain areas and so on, you know, that they would put them right into the ground.
In a shallow grave.
That's the way they did it. But, you know, with us, now that we have caskets that we use, the casket itself, as we learned, that if it is, it contains, let's say, at least 4 tefachim, then in that particular case, we say that the cover already, we had that in connection with the tefillin, if you remember. So we say that the cover already acts as if it were a separate mechitza, so that what's inside is, you know, the domain of the mess, but above it, it would not be, give you a tumor or something like that. But again, I mean, these are such technicalities that it's better for a kohen not to be there unless it's actually, you know, for a mess mitzvah or where the Torah commanded that he has to be metami for a kohen. All right.
So now we
all right. So they say, okay, whose opinion is it, you know, that about Manshon de Doma Kule Bayis Ki Arba Amos Domi, who is the authority who says that the entire room acts like one private domain? Kaaba Amos, right? And even if it's a big room, right? So he says, Rabbi Shimon Alozahi. This is Rabbi Shimon Alozahi's opinion.
Hmm.
Okay, so in other words, now we know that who is the author of one and who's the author of the other. All right, so this represents the opinion of Shimon Alozahi. Then we have to say that the other opinion, namely, you know, that if you stand, you know, 4 amos away, you know, to the side, whatever it may be, so this is the opinion then of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. All right, so that's how we deduce who it is. And that way everybody is consistent with their own point of view. All right, so now they ask a different question. Okay. Rabbi Shimon, right. So Omar Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef said, Bo'ai minei mi Rav Huno. I asked the following question, he said, of Rav Huno. He says, Mito pochos mishlosho. He says, if the bed were less than 3 tfachim from the floor, pshitali, then it is obvious to me, the chilibud domi, that it is similar to a levud. And this is a technical thing that I have to explain to you, what is a levud. Okay? Levud is, what do we call it? We call it a legal fiction. Okay? It's a legal fiction which says that if you have a space, if the space is less than 3 tefachim, now remember the tefach is roughly about, what is it, about 4 inches or something. In other words, if it is less, yeah, a tefach is a handful, right. But, you know, in terms of inches, it would be, what, maybe about 3 to 4 inches, okay?
It must be equivalent to the hand that they measure for.
Yeah, right. I mean, the question is whose hand, you know? It's the old story. Like they say, how did we ever derive the idea of a foot being 12 inches? So somebody said, well, they measured it against Charlemagne's foot, and they made that the standard. How true it is, I don't know. The fact of the matter is that the Romans were already using the word foot. I mean, after all, what is a mile? In Latin, the word is mille passus, which means 1,000 paces, 1,000 steps, literally, okay? But naturally, then they have to define, what are they talking about? They're talking about 1 foot in front of the other? Of course not. What they're talking about is that when a person marched, there was a certain amount of space between 1 foot and the next foot, and so on. And that, if you multiplied by 1,000, that gave you the Roman mile. So, all right, so getting back over here, all right, what is a levud? A levud, as I said, is if there is a hollow space, and that space is no more than 3 tefachim, then you can consider it as if it were joined to the 2 sides that are beside it, and it's like covering, one covering. Okay? Let me explain what is going on over here. With the bed, this is as follows. He says, okay, if the bed were placed less than, you know, not up to 3 tefachim from the ground, then on the basis of the principle of levud, then it's as if the chamber pot, which is underneath it, okay, was in the ground, okay? And after all, if it's in the ground, then we don't worry about it, okay? It's covered over, it's in the ground, and even though it's not in the ground, but still, on the basis of this legal fiction, then that's so. In the law of Sukkah, the law of levud also plays an important factor. Okay? Talking specifically about how much space do you have to leave, and this is particularly so between where you put the schach at the end, the roof, right? And, you know, the fact that, let's say that you leave a space between where you lay the first board or whatever it may be, as compared to the side of the sukkah, okay? So if the board is close enough, it's less than 3 tefachim to the side, even though there's an empty space over there, and then the law of levud applies, it is as if it were covered over in that area. So that this is the din. So that, for example, if this were my sukkah over here, okay, and for some reason, pardon me,
constructive enclosure.
Yeah, okay, whatever you want to say. I mean, I don't know the legal technicalities. I know what lavud is, but if you say constructive enclosure, fine, okay. But let's say instead of having the board right over here, right to the end, let's say it were over here, okay. As long as this is less than 3 tefachim, it's as if it were covered, right, and joined to the wall. That's so. See, there's a practical application for it. All right. So, getting back, so he says, look, if it's less than 3 tefachim, then shitodid kilavudami. If it's less than that, then obviously the law of lavud would apply, and therefore it's as if it were part of the ground, okay? No question. Now, the question is, he says, Shlosha, Arboa, Chamisha, Shisha, Shiva, Shmona, Tisha, Mahu. What if it's, let's say, 3 tefachim, 4 tefachim, 5 tefachim, 6, 7, 8, 9 tefachim high? What is the din over there? So, Amalei, so he said to him, Lo Yodana, I don't know. He says, Atzora Vadai, Lomi Boili. If it were 10 tefachim, there's no question in my own mind that this law of Lavud would not apply, right? Why? Because Hasorah, it's already high enough to be a separate domain. You understand?
10 tefachim.
As we said before, right, 10 tefachim is already a different domain altogether. So you can't say even that it's covered over or anything like that, you see, okay? Because obviously it's too high up. But, you know, if it's somewhere between 3 and 10, then what? I don't know what the answer is, he says. So, Abaye said, Shapir avartut lo ibaye lechok. Says, it's a good thing, he says, that you didn't ask, about. You know, so he says, Kol asar reshusach vitehe. Nobody doubts, he says, that once it's 10 to tefachim, it's a different reshus. Okay? But what about in the intermediate? So the answer is, how should we paskin? Should we paskin lechum or should we paskin lekul? Let's say the bed is 4 tefachim high and the chamber pot is underneath it. So the answer is, when it's something which is doubtful, if it is midoraisa, then we always paskin lechum and say no. Well, krishma to a certain extent is a mitzvah doraisa. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because the Torah commanded us. So that therefore, if it's not really adequately covered because the bed already is too high above the chamber pot, then in that case we should not do it. Okay? So Amar Rava, yes. Hilchaso da halacha, he says as follows. Pachos mishloisha kilavudami. If it is less than 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the lavud, which we said, okay, like part of the ground in this case, right? Kilavudami. Asoro, if it's 10, he says, vishusach vitehi, then it's a different vishus altogether. But mishloisha ad asoro, from 3 to 10, Aine Debor Mine, Rab Yosef, Rab Huna. This is what the question was that Rab Yosef asked Rab Huna, below Poshatle, and he didn't give him an answer. So, Omar Rav, so Rav said, Haloch Rab Shimon ben Elozer. So he says that the Haloch follows Rab Shimon ben Elozer. Alright, getting back again to what did Rab Shimon ben Elozer say? He said that a room, no matter how long it is, right? You should not say Krishma in such a room unless you have either taken it out of the room or hid it underneath, but underneath, obviously, to the extent, that it shouldn't be more than 3 tefachim high.
Right.
So as I said, we have to go to the Chum in this case. The Chenamar Bali Amar Rav Yaakov, the Rei Devas Shmuel, And likewise, Bali said in the name of Rabbi Yaakov, the son of the daughter of Shimon, says, Halacha Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Halacha follows him in this case. The Rabbi Omar and Rabbi said, Ein Halacha Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. But Rabbi says, no, the Halacha doesn't follow him. Okay, so take your pick.
They leave you hanging.
Right. It's better, therefore, that we have, you know, our own modern bathrooms, where
you
go into the bathroom and you don't have to worry about it.
You don't have to worry about it.
What David asked before? Is there a ketur for someone that's sick? Is there an exemption for someone that's sick?
That already is a different problem. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I don't know that a sick person is obligated to say Shema or Shema.
All right, that's number one. I mean, if a person is very ill, you know, he might be excused from performing all mitzvahs. But let's say a person is well enough to do it. So you have the question, you know, what should you do if, for example, you know, you have a catheter and it's pulling urine out.
You went through that.
Into a bag, right, exactly. Of course I had it in the hospital. And, you know, a lot of people, it's a very common occurrence today. So I asked the shaila just to be on the safe side. And the answer was that it's all right. In other words, they felt it sort of like in the idea that, you know, it's not right on top of the bed with you, but it's hanging underneath. So in that case, you can say Krishna as long as you're above the bed, and that's, you know, someplace below.
Was it hanging underneath? It wasn't like under the covers?
You know, if it were under the covers, so there you have the other question about, you know, legal res verba. If there's enough covering, you know, that your genitals are covered from the rest of the body, then we learned a couple of weeks ago that you're permitted to say Krishna. So, either way, you see, if you want to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of Krishna, then you could do it. But, you know, there are those who are machmir and said that if you're in this state, you shouldn't say. But that's not right. A Jew wants to be able to perform every mitzvah that he can. And even if he's under those circumstances where he's hospitalized and he can't do everything that he would like to do, but nevertheless, he should be encouraged to do as many mitzvahs as he possibly can. And it would not be, in this particular case, you know, similar to the business that, after all, why do we say that you should not say Krishna facing a chamber pot? Because obviously, it's not the right atmosphere to say it. It shows a certain contempt, but where you can't help yourself, the element of contempt is not there, you see.
Right.
Okay. So,
right.
All right.
Wow.
All right. So, Rav Achai Yasak Lei Livrei Be Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel. All right. So here is a story about Rav Achai, who arranged for a shidduch for his son at the house of Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta. Okay? That's fine, he wanted to make a shidduch for his son. And then Ayalei L'chupa. And then he brought him into the chupa. In other words, he married off his son, right? And lo and behold, you know what happened? V'lo hava mistaya milsa. The son couldn't get it up in plain language. He was impotent on his marriage night, right? He was impotent. Okay. Well, Mistayle Milsa means, and the thing didn't help.
Is that what it means?
But this is what it means.
Which does what could you give two the word at a time?
Below Haba, and it was not Mistaya helping him, Milsa, this matter. But what it means is that he wasn't, I mean, very simply, what it means in our context over here is that he wasn't able to perform like a man should perform on his wedding night, okay? Wasn't able to do it.
Considering that he gets married so young, it's very understandable sometimes.
Okay.
It could be kids.
At any rate, he wanted to find out what was wrong.
When he goes to sleep, he's a kid.
Yeah. So he wanted to find out what was wrong. So Azal Basrei, so he followed him, in order to take a look around and see why was it that his son was impotent. So Chaz Sefer Torah, so he saw that there was a Sefer Torah the mantle which was lying there in the room. Omalagu, so he said to them, you know, to the Mechatonim, he says, Ichol Hashtob. Hey, he says, what are you doing right now? Lo asai sakantu nevri? What's the matter? You're trying to endanger my son? D'tanya, haven't we learned that bias, again, it doesn't mean here a house, but a room, sheyesh bo sefer Torah, a room in which there is a sefer Torah, o tefillin, or it has tefillin in it, is also the shamish bo yisamito, then he is prohibited from having marital intercourse in this room, ad sheyotziyem, until he has taken them out of the room, or if he puts them inside one receptacle and then inside another receptacle. In other words, if it's doubly sealed away, so then, you know, he could do it. But otherwise, he's not allowed to. And Omar Abaye, said, as well, he says, Leishonu elevit li sheino kilyon. He says, here we're talking about putting them in a receptacle which is not the normal receptacle for them, where, and he says, and you have to double bag it, so to speak, okay, you have to put in the receptacle within the receptacle, but avol bechli shehu kilyon, but if it's the receptacle which is the normal thing, so he says apilo asora monik echad monodomi, then even if you put it into 10, he says you're not allowed to do it, because there's a certain kedusha, in other words, which is attached to the, let's say, if you keep, we're used, you know, to keeping the sefer Torah in a vertical position, right? That's the way we do it. But let's say that you had a box, a chest, in which you kept the sefer Torah, and it was kept horizontal, okay? So the point that he's making is that if this is the chest in which you keep it all the time, then in that case, even putting it into 10 kelim, is not right. You have to take it out of the room, so that you display the proper sense of kedusha towards this article, which is a holy article, and even for its receptacle, which becomes sanctified as a result of its use in connection with it. And of course, the same thing technically would apply to tefillin. Others even apply to chumashim. They say that if you have chumashim, you have to cover it up if you're going to have intercourse in, you know, in the same room in which you keep chumashim. Okay? Or
it only goes down up to chumashim, not Torah.
The reason being because chumashim, after all, you know, it's like Torah, you see. That's basically.
But so is the siddur with so many of the paragraphs.
Okay, but you know, still, I mean, some people keep a siddur, let's say, in order to read Krishma at night or something before they go to bed or something like that. Okay? Yeah, that would be the right thing, putting it in the drawer. No question.
But what if
you
have
you don't have to worry then, however, about putting it.
Yeah. What if you have the film in the closet?
I don't think it's
right.
Right.
Okay, we'll see in a second. We'll see in a second. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Let me gain a bit of a vitamin. We'll answer your question. Okay. Omar Rava. Rava said, he says, Galimov, if you have a covering, a kamtara, over a chest, in other words, let's say you have a chest and then you put like a rug or a drape or something on top of it, then he says, kichli b'soch kli dami. Then this is the same as if you had one kli inside the other. And in that particular case, it would be permissible as long as the chest in which you keep these things is covered up. Okay? Omar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi said as follows. He says, Sefer Torah, he says, if you have a Sefer Torah in the house, then Tzorech Lasleis Loi Mechitza Asor, then you have to make a partition which is at least 10 tefachim high. As we said, 10 tefachim is already is like legally a different domain. Okay? So if you had then what he's saying is that if you would put a partition at least 10 tefachim high between the Sefer Torah and
Yibad,
then there would be permissible. From this, incidentally, we can learn something else, and that is what should technically be the lowest minimum of
Yibad. Right.
Ten tefachim. Right.
That's the minimum.
The minimum, in other words, should run in the neighborhood of about 40 inches.
40 inches.
It should be approximately. All right. In other words, between 3 and 4 feet high, that would be the minimum.
Is that cool?
I'm not measuring.
This is what it should be. But again, I don't have to tell you there are chumras, there are kulas. The kula is, as Rabbi Weisfeld claims, was told to him by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, to put in the bracha. He claims that he consulted with him, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said that as long as there is no negia, as long as the men and the women can't touch each other over the mechitza, then that's okay.
I know.
We got guys who are romantically inclined, I know. But this is what Rav Moshe said.
Right.
Well, this is what I make sure that we do when it comes to High Holiday. We put the seats down over there. They were not so careful in previous years. But the past few years, I've been insisting, you know.
So you're actually putting a Dalet Amos away.
Right.
Right next to it.
Remove, you know, a row or two of chairs on each side of the mechitza.
The other thing under the chair. Right. Now, how about the ones that are permanently there? You have no choice there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Can somebody actually
reach
across from?
Yeah, technically it's possible, but
the man doesn't have the aisle. Right,
there is the aisle. Well, they would have to have an awful long reach, however, to get across the aisle in order to touch the woman.
You're thinking of the seats we put up. I'm talking about permanent seats we have.
No, I'm talking even so.
No, right there, on the other side of the mechitza.
We have an aisle. No. Oh, the women go up to the mechitza, you're right.
The women go right up to the mechitza.
Yeah, but then there is an aisle before the men's chairs begin.
If you're talking about sitting in the chair, you're right.
Yeah.
Who sits in the chair? I want to talk to the women.
But you're saying that you go actually to 10 fucking away as
he
well as high, but 10
fucking
removed. Is that what you're saying?
It should really be Dalet Amos.
Dalet Amos. That's
really
what I thought. Dalet Amos. Sure.
In order to make sure that they don't get within the.
That's my understanding of Feinstein.
Well, listen, as I say, I'm only relying upon what I heard. Rabbeisha did not tell me this personally, so
no,
I can't
away.
Say, right. I would
away.
Say that it would be better if we had really,
six feet.
But maybe we don't need 6 feet. Maybe 4 feet would be enough or something like that. As long, basically, that, you know, there is no contact between one and the other. Of course, I don't have to tell you. Among Hasidim, this is
they
not.
They go all the way up.
They go all the way up, and they put curtains and everything else, or they put them in a different room altogether, and so on.
Yeah, with a little hole
to
take a lesson.
But as I say, from here at least we can learn something, you see, which applies not only over here, but it could apply in other areas as well.
The minimum would be in the basement. Where the women sit.
They put up a portable.
They put a screen up.
Portable screens they put up. Yeah.
And so they do the same thing in the annex.
Where downstairs?
Where the amphine goes.
Yeah.
Upstairs they have a
balcony.
Nobody is sitting in the balcony for years. Not since Kadima moved out.
There were a few. You're not there for the Yemen Naraim, they're there.
Yeah. Okay.
Upstairs.
Okay.
I'm
not going to say come. I'm not going to say where did you come sometime.
Okay. So anyway, he says, if you have a Sefer Torah in the room, so he said to him, whose opinion are you following? Says Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. So Amor, I can say then the Omar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, the less lay Pesach Rino. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said that when is this mechitza good for a Sefer Torah? That's if you don't have any other room. Okay? In other words, if you're living in a one-room house,
then you
and
have to build
a Sefer Torah over there, then you have to put up a mechitza between the Sefer Torah and where you are. I would say but preferably, if you have the room, you have another room, then it's better that to take the Sefer Torah out and put it in the other room, and then you can go ahead and have a good time.
And okay. Usually you cover it with a talus or something. Yeah.
So it's at the in the Leislei Beis Akino. Mar ho Yislei Beis Akino. Look, he says, you have another room. So Malay, he says, Labadatai, he says, you know, I didn't think about that. Okay, then getting back again, we said that Kama Yachik Mehen Minatzor, this goes back to the original Mishnah. And the Mishnah there, if you remember, said that how far do you have to remove yourself from a body of water, like, water in which you're steeping flax, or water in which there is urine inside, how far do you have to? So we said, or, you know, from Min Hatzoa, from excrement itself, you have to go back at least Arba'amas, all right? So Omar Rava, Omar Rav Sechora, so Rava said the name Rav Sechora, Omar Rav Kunin, the name Rav Kunin, he says, Leishonu Elo Liachra. So they said, that's only if you step back, not if you step back, but if, you know, you have your back to what it is. This is what he means. You have your back to it, right? So you go a distance of 6 amas. Avolafonov. But if you're facing it, then he says, Machik Moloeno. Then you have to go as far away from it as your eye can see. In other words, once it's out of view,
out of sight.
Right, out of sight, then that's okay. Then you can say Krishna.
Over the horizon.
Yeah, wherever. But if you can see it, then in that case you're not allowed to, if you're facing it. The chen b'filah, what we said about Krishma, applies likewise to Shmoneser.
So he says, Aini, isn't this so? The Omar Rafram Bar Rova, Bar Papa, didn't Rafram Bar Papa say, Omar Rafisba, name Rafisba, he said, Omeid Odom Keneged Beis HaKisei, Mispalil, that a man can stand facing a Beis HaKisei in Davin, Shmid Esra? So he says, Achum Ma'askin, and hey, what kind of a Beis HaKisei are we talking about? He says, the Beis HaKisei, Shem Beitzoya, right? Beis HaKisei in which there is no excrement, no feces in it. Aini, isn't that so? The Omar Rav Yosef Barachanin, didn't Rav Yosef Barachanin say, Beis HaKisei Sha'omru? No, the Beis HaKisei that they were talking about is Apal Pisha Ein Botzoa. Even though there isn't any excrement in there, still you cannot what? You cannot face it when you daven. Uveis HaMechotz, and the bathhouse where it says you're not allowed to daven in the bathhouse either, right? Even if there's nobody in there, so then in that case, what are we talking about where we said that it is permitted to daven? He says, so what are we dealing with? He says, we're talking about a brand new one which has not yet been used, either as a bathhouse
or
as a Beis HaKisei. So they say, but doesn't this raise a kasha about Rabino? What? That says his bino the Beis HaKisei mahu yezimu and enzimu by the head. We had this before a few pages back. That Ravina asked the following question. He says, if a man decides in his mind, he says, I'm going to set aside this as a Beis HaKisei, right?
Yeah.
So what are we to say? Mahu. Are we to say yesh zimun? Are we to say then that this is effective already, which means therefore that this is now officially
a
Beis HaKisei, and therefore we should not face it or stand in it and daven? Or ain zimun? Or should we say that the law of zimun does not apply until you actually begin using it for that purpose? Just putting it aside doesn't by itself affect it yet. So it says ki boma boya later rabino. So when the question was asked of Rabino Lameka Malay Litzui Begabe, so he says about the question that he says is not whether you're permitted to daven within it. Obviously what? Not allowed to daven within. Abol Kenegdo, right? But if you stand facing it, Lay Umaroba. But if you're facing it, don't. That's all there is to it. Omar Rabba said, Hani Bote Kisai de Parsi, he says, you know, the toilets that the Persians have, Apal Gav de Hisbehu Tzoa, even though they have excrement in them, Kistumendome, it's as if they are closed up. Now, what kind of toilets did they have that were different? So Rashi explains that they built their toilets in a different fashion than, let's say, the toilets in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, toilets in Eretz Yisrael were plain, simple affairs that they sat down on, you know, a bench or something, a hole, and whatever dropped. That's all. Okay, this was the Beis HaKisei. But the Persians, they built. He says that you sat down, and then there was a slope underneath, which led Dalit Amos away to a place where the excrement was. So he says, there already, you're not actually sitting on top. So it's as though the Beis HaKisei were
Dalit Amos.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it's on this basis that we could say that our own flush toilets today are like what it mentions over here concerning, you know, the privies. The toilets of the Persians, because in our place, you know, once we flush it down the drain, so it's kistumin. It's as if it were completely covered over again, and the excrement is no longer there. Okay, and now to go down the home stretch.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this goes back. Here we have the actual Mishnah, which was already quoted to a certain extent before. Okay, yeah, that's all right.
I still am lost on the halacha here. I mean, if you do have an unused kisei, which actually I suppose is somewhat like what you're saying in that,
correct?
You were walking into,
Persian. Yeah.
Are you then allowed to say?
Kriyat Shema.
Kriyat Shema.
Within it?
On the north side.
Within it, definitely it? Not. Within facing it, it yes, yeah. But modern etiquette would call for closing the door. Right. Don't stand and face an open toilet when you're talking, okay?
Right. Okay.
Now, I'm not saying if it's 2-3 rooms away, you know, down at the end of the corridor, but I'm saying that if you are davening,
you're facing,
in
your bedroom,
so
your bedroom.
Even though the bathroom at the moment is clean, but nevertheless, the door should be closed. There's no question about that.
And this is the
like making a mechitza, it's the same idea.
Right.
Make a mechitza.
And this is the same with the baking seat that was new, that wasn't used yet.
Right, and as we see, right. Granted, you know, that if it's never been used, then technically it would be permissible. And yet, it's not. I mean, we wouldn't do it today.
As long as it's set aside for that purpose.
Right, because already the idea is mino, even though it's only a mental reservation, so to speak, in your mind. But nevertheless, it's something to consider.
Matter of respect.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we still want to retain, you know, the greatest kedusha, the sense of holiness when we recite our prayers. Okay, now the final Mishnah of this chapter says, Zov Shara Keri, the Nido Shepolta Shechazera, the Hamishamesh Shara Son Nido. Okay, let's define each of these three. Alright, first of all, let's put it in its context. Its context, believe it or not, goes back again to what we had earlier in the chapter about the Takon assessment.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Where we said what? That if you become a Balkeri, and in that particular case, according to Ezra, you have to toivel before you're permitted to say Krishma or to learn Torah and so on. Okay? So now they ask the following question in the Mishnah. It says, Zov, how about the case of a Zov? A Zov, remember, is a person who has like a flow caused by gonorrhea. This is how they usually explain it, okay? At any rate, the Zov is unclean for 7 days, okay? And the Nido, the woman who is menstruant, okay, Shepolto Shechvat Zera. And during the moment, you know, while she is already menstruant, understand? All of a sudden she has a discharge from the last intercourse. And, you know, so that she discharges seminal fluid from the last intercourse, okay? Or the Hamshameshes, a woman was having intercourse with her husband, Shara saw Nido, and suddenly she saw what? That she had started to menstruate, okay? So it says, Tzrichin Filon, they require immersion. But what is the Mishnah talking about? As I said, we have to relate this to what we said before about the Kama Sesra. According to the author, in other words, according to the Tanna Kamma, whoever is the authority at the beginning of this Mishnah, he would say as follows. Even though we know that Azov remains unclean for 7 days, right? You understand?
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if he then were to table himself, it would not affect his status as a Zov. He would still remain a Zov during the specified period of time, right? So that the Tevila actually is no good for him, but nevertheless, according to this Tanna Kamma, he feels that he should still immerse himself in the mikveh before what? Before davening, before saying Krishna, okay? This is his feeling, okay? Now, likewise with the two other cases. The woman who was already menstruant and then she had a seminal discharge, okay? Now, normally if a woman has a seminal discharge after intercourse, so technically she was supposed to do what? She was supposed to immerse herself, just as a man was supposed to immerse himself before studying Torah, right? But if she is already a Nida, then what good does the immersion do? Well, but according to the Tanna Kamma, if she wants to say Krishna, she should immerse herself, even though it's not going to affect the fact that she still remains a Nida. Do you understand?
You mean even though she's menstruating to immerse herself?
Yes.
That's what the Tanakam is saying. If she wants to say Krishna, then she should immerse herself after seeing
even
the seminal discharge.
She's still menstruating.
Right, even though she's still menstruating. Hmm. Okay? And the third case, as we said, is the case of the woman who, you know, she had had intercourse, and then she suddenly discovered that she had
discharge.
You know, that she had, that she was menstruating. Okay?
Oh, yes.
Now, obviously, when she starts to menstruate, she's a nida. All right. And so just going and immersing herself after, you know, having had intercourse, it's not going to do any good as far as right. But nevertheless, what is his feeling? His feeling is that she should still immerse herself. Not that it's going to take away the state of being a nido, but it will at least enable her to say Krishna. This is what the Tanakhama says, okay?
That's the same for the Zav.
Right, the same for all these three.
Even though he may not be clean.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Rabbi Yehuda poter, but Rabbi Yehuda excuses them. In other words, what does Rabbi Yehuda excuse them from? These tevilas. Of course, remember we said the same thing before. It was Rabbi Yehuda who said what? That the Takana of Ezra doesn't apply anymore. Why? Because there's two reasons. One is, you know, the fact that it may lead to Bittul Torah,
yeah.
Right? That people who should be studying Torah, of course, or saying Krishna or something like that, that they won't be able to take the fact that every time that they want to do it, they have to run into the mikveh first.
Mm.
So it's going to lead to too much bittul Torah. And the other one, of course, as we said, I mean, is the fact that we wanted to encourage purity of Arivia. We wanted to encourage to be fruitful and multiply. And if every time that a man or a woman has intercourse, you say, okay, you had intercourse, go in Teuvel.
Because you can't say
we'd have to build about 100 other mikvahs, you see, than what we have
what
right now.
What does Bittul mean?
Bittul means literally neglect.
Neglect
of Torah, right.
Okay.
Yeah. It has different meanings. It also means like, you know, that you decided it has no value, whatever, or something like that. It's also Bittul, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Bittul Zman is a waste of time and things
yeah,
like that.
I've heard that. That's
right.
Why I asked.
All right, so we boil it. So the question was asked. Balkeri, the Balkeri, Sharoa Zivo, right? He was a Balkeri, and then all of a sudden he sees that he is now a Zav, in addition to being a Balkeri. Okay?
Right.
So, the Rabbi Yehuda Mahu, what is the din for Rabbi Yehuda? Are we to say Kipota Rabbi Yehuda, that when Rabbi Yehuda said that he doesn't have to be Toivel in order to say Krishna, it was Hossam Azov Sharoa Keri, right? We're talking about Azov who then saw a seminal discharge to Meikora, because to begin with, Lav Bartvilahu, he was not, able, in other words, to get out of his state of being Azov by virtue of Tefillah, and that's why Rabbi Yehuda excused him for that. Aval Balkeri, but in the case of the Balkeri, who according to Rabbi Yehuda, right? At first we said no, right? But anyway, he started as a Balkeri. Sharoa Ziva, who then saw that he was having the discharge of a Zav, the Miyikora Bat Filavu. According to the law of Ezra, he should have immersed himself to begin with because he was a Balkeri. Right. So Mechayev, does he require him then? Therefore, should we say, does Rabbi Yehuda require him to immerse himself in the mikveh, even though he's now a zav? Or Dilmor, or perhaps you say Leishnov, makes no difference whether he started out as a zav and then became a Balkeri, or whether he started out as a Balkeri and then he became a zav. So Tashma, in order to resolve this question, we invoke another statement. It's written, Hamish HaMeshes, if a woman had intercourse with Raso Nido, right? And she saw Nido, then she saw that, you know, she was menstruant, then Sricho Tevila. Then in that particular case, she requires immersion. Rabbi Yehuda Poter, but Rabbi Yehuda excuses her, right? From the Tevila. Because he says, what good is it going to do her? She's a nida,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
The home ishameshes, and likewise the case of the woman who had intercourse, verason nidor, right? And she then discovered that she was nidor. Isn't that like Kaval Keri, you know, like the man who had a seminal discharge, Sharoz Zivon, Damia, right? It is like it. They called Pata Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda nevertheless excused him. So Shema Minei, from this we learn that what? That makes no difference whether it's one or the other. In they case, are not required to toivel themselves in order to say Krishna or to daven or whatever it may be.
Well, they're not required to toivel themselves. Right. They're not required. They can't say Krishna or Shema Nesra either.
According to Rabbi Yehuda, they are permitted to do it. Yeah. According to Takana says, well, they would have to immerse themselves before, okay? Yeah. But Rabbi Yehuda says they are not required to immerse themselves. And no matter what the circumstances, it's not going to help them in any case, yes.
What is the Shin Mem again?
Shin Mem in Shema Minor. From this we learn. Shema, listen, Minor from this. In other words, we derive the idea from this. Okay. Tani, we have another statement that we have learned, Rabbi Chiya Behedyo. Rabbi Chiya said specifically, he taught that what? Bal Keri Sharoz Ziva Tzorich Tevila. For Rabbi Yehuda Poter, again, we can, you know, there is a statement which says specifically that Rabbi Chiya said that he should, and Rabbi Yehuda said, no, it doesn't have to. And of course, I don't have to tell you that we follow who's.
Rabbi Chiya says that we should table ourselves.
That he should table himself before Davin, based on the Takon of Ezra.
And Yehuda says again.
And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, he's
fixed by his gun.
And of course, as I said, we follow the halacha follows.
Rabbi Yehuda, Poter.
So, Hadron Aloch Misha Moiso, and of course, we finished in this chapter. And Yitzhak Hashem, next week we will start a brand new chapter, Tefillas HaShachar, in which we go into the question of Shemoneh Esrei, and all kinds of beautiful things that we'll be learning at that time.
So we
learned from this chapter all kinds of things. We really started with Misha Mesa, if you remember. If a person is, you know, has just suffered a loss, someone near and dear to him, so we learned the fact that he's Potem and Kriya Shema, and so on. And then we learned that you shouldn't do it in the room where the mess is lying, out of respect for the mess, and we learned also, you know, what do you know, the people going to the cemetery, that they have to be menachem and so on, that you have to have the shura, and you
know, the way to go,
right, and the way to go, and who is excused from Krishna, and who is not excused from saying Krishna, if you're bearers of the mitzvah, you know, with the beer to the cemetery, and so on and so forth. And then from that we went into the general idea of, you know, under what circumstances is it proper to say Krishna, and under what circumstances is it not, whether it is a physical disability on your part, or is it, you know, the fact that you are in a location where it doesn't lend itself to Kedusha. And of course the overriding principle again, as we can see, is that we should approach prayer exactly with fear, with trembling, and with a sense of awe and holiness. So, Birkas Hashem next week.
Next week. We start with the third or fourth parak.
Yes, we start the next parak.
Take a break at 8:30, so we can go home and see the president. It's supposed to be on 9:00.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
All right, so let's get started. Okay, we have the honor of starting chapter 4 now, Tefillas HaShachar. We'll be learning it with Rashi, Tosfos.
So we're on Chof Vav.
Yeah, Ram Chof Vav, Amud Aleph.
Amud Aleph.
Beginning of the fourth chapter. Right?
Yep.
Okay, testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
I know that you have the test.
No, what? I'm waiting for David to find the place.
Yeah, good.
Okay,
thank
we
you.
Got it?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Now, the fourth chapter is going.
Sorry, is this a.
That's
title?
The start of
it. Yeah, yes. Oh, you want to know what it says over there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've never been here
what you see in the dark over there, it says, Hadron Aloch Misha Meso, which means, may we return to you again, Misha Meso. You'll find at the end of every
end
chapter,
of
right. Okay. So as the chapter is completed, so, you know, when we finish a book in the Torah, we say Chazak, Chazak, Chazak. But in the Gemara,
when they finish a chapter, they say, Hadron Allah, may we return unto you. And, you know, you have the name of the chapter. And then at the end, they have not only the name of the chapter, but also the name of the Masechta. We will take a look over here at the very end. I'll tell you where it is. It's on Samach Dalid. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, there it says Hadron Allah Horoeth. The name of the ninth chapter happens to be Horoeth.
Mm-hmm.
When we get to there, with God's help, we'll discover what it's about. But it deals with, you know, prophets for such things as seeing places where miracles have happened, seeing the ocean when you haven't seen it for a long time, seeing the deserts and things like that. So the name of that chapter is Horoeth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Salika Law, and this is the end of Maseches Brachos.
So then
what you have over there, you have a little prayer that we say, Amir Tzashem, when these days we get there. When we finish Kedushin, if you remember that Sunday morning,
yes,
I went through the whole ceremony, right?
Yeah.
So Amir Tzashem, one of these months, we'll do the same thing with Maseches Brachos.
God willing.
You can see we're not quite halfway through, but this chapter should go a little bit faster because it has also a lot of Agarata, and the next chapter too. After that, we get back again to sort of brass tacks and so on.
Okay.
All right. But this deals with a very important subject. I just wanted to remind you that the first three chapters that we've just completed dealt primarily with the problem of Kriya Shema. When to say it, under what circumstances, and so on and so forth, okay? And of course, we learned many, many different dinim in connection with that, as well as very beautiful statements, agadata, and so on, in that connection. We learned some very wonderful material. Halavai, we get back to it again and review it, because these are the kind of things we shouldn't forget.
Also, ways of handling the tefillin and so forth.
Right, yes. So now we're dealing with Shmona Esrei. So the first Mishnah speaks about Tfilas HaShachar Ad Chatzos. The Shmona Esrei, if Shachris, can be recited until noon. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ad Dalichos. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, the limit is till the fourth hour. Now, the Gemara, of course, is going to ask a different question. They want to know, does it mean then till the end of the fourth hour? Or does it mean only until the beginning of the fourth hour?
What is the fourth hour? Actually, it's the fourth hour of the watch, the morning watch.
Yeah, correct. In other words, if you have, you know, sunrise and sunset, so you have to divide the period of time that you have between sunrise and sunset, divide it by 12, and that gives you the hour. That particular day, and then of course you divide it by 60 and you have how much, you know, the minute is. So it does not correspond to the hours that we have on our clock. I mean, we may use it, you know, simply for illustration, but on the other hand, as you know, it varies from day to day.
So the time that you can daven shachris, therefore, varies from day to day.
This is correct.
As the time gets shorter or longer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So this is one of the problems. I mean, the fact that, for example, in the summertime, you know, you don't have that much time. Of course, we in the summer we go on daylight saving, so that gives us a little bit extra time. But technically, you know, we should be finished earlier than in the winter time when the days are short. And that, therefore, you know, the amount of time would be corresponding. But actually, it's not going to make that much difference.
You have to know the exact sunrise time.
Right. This is true.
But so you take the sunrise and sunset, divide by 12. You have,
correct,
let's say, 12 equal periods of time.
Correct.
Okay?
That's right.
Now you say the fourth hour. Does that mean the fourth hour after sunrise?
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
All right. In other words, if we were to say that sunrise was at 6 o'clock in the morning, right?
Right.
And that sunset was at 6 o'clock in the evening, which would be, you know,
exactly,
this would be perfect,
hours, right?
Then in that case,
you can daven shachris until 10.
Right. This is if you take
the at the end of the night.
The question is until 10 o'clock. As I said, or does it mean until the end of the fourth hour, which would be just before 11 o'clock?
Right.
Okay? No, actually, it's not quite that. The first hour of the morning would be, let's say, from 6 to 6 7.
6 to 7.
All
seven
right, second would be 7 to 8.
8 to 9.
8 to 9, right.
And 9 to 10.
9 to 10. That would be the end.
End of the course. So the
right,
tenth.
Because 10 o'clock then would be the beginning of the fifth hour.
Right.
And 11 o'clock would be the beginning of the sixth hour.
So you'd have to down someone somewhere
have
between
noon.
9 and 10 if to make the speed
correct.
Of the line.
Correct.
Could
yeah,
you just
so
go over the Mishnah?
Sure. Me?
I'm sorry to
yeah. So far,
listen,
we have learned
only
the first
phrase.
You're defining what late means.
Listen, I want you to know that David was practically number 10 man tonight. So.
Oh, was it? You're excused.
Help save the day. So, okay. The Mishnah starts by saying, Tfilas HaShakarat Hatzos, which means that the Shmoyma Esri that we could recite in the morning has to be recited by noon. This is what the Chachomim say, okay? I mean, it doesn't say the Chachomim, but obviously it's an anonymous statement, okay? And it does represent the view of the Chachomim. All right, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Ad Dalet Shavuos, only until the fourth hour. So we just got through with the discussion, what do we mean by the fourth hour? So we said, if we were to assume that sunrise, right, was at 6 in the morning and sunset at 6 in the evening and divide that by 12, so it means that the first hour of the morning would be from 6 to 7, the second hour from 7 to 8, the third hour from 8 to 9, and the fourth hour is from 9 to 10. We're going to have the question raised, however, also about what does it mean, ad? Does ad mean only until but no further than? In other words, it would mean that, you know, by 9 o'clock you have to be finished with the Shmoneh Esrei, or do you have also the fourth hour, which would mean you should have Daven Shmoneh Esrei by 10 o'clock? Okay, but for the time being, let's assume the second one.
So you have up until 10 o'clock.
Right. Now, what did we learn about Krishna? See if we remember.
I wasn't here, but it was something about the sunrise.
Well,
yeah, right, okay. The question is how soon you start. I mean, when can you? As a matter of fact, the time that was recommended happened to be just prior to sunrise.
Yeah. 72
we'll
minutes
have a
after
reference to that, too. Mm-hmm. We'll come back.
72 minutes after the morning star rises.
Well, it's the other way around.
Oh,
in other words,
72 minutes before the morning.
The Amud Hashachar, in other words, the morning star rises 72 minutes prior to sunrise. Okay? So that actually it's still dark yet outside when the morning star rises, but it's the official beginning of daytime. Okay. How do we know that? Because we have Psukim, you know, we have verses in the book of Nehemiah, Ezra Nehemiah, where he speaks about the work of building the walls of Jerusalem when he got the people there, you know, in order to defend the city. And it said, you know, that they worked from, you know, night until morning, Alalos HaShachar, and then, you know, the other half worked the other shift. So from Amud HaShachar, from Alos HaShachar, Amud HaShachar, you know, until sunset, okay? So that from this we know already then that this is the official start of the day. Okay? So, alright, but that was the official start. But the question is, and until what time are we permitted? Well, alright. Let's look back a little bit.
It's been a while since we...
Yeah, right, it has been a long time.
I'm sorry, what was the question? Until what time?
Until what time is it the Rishma? Right. We had it on Tess on the base. That's where it was discussed. All right, let's review that question. Mishnah there says, "Be'matzai Koranish Mabishakris," right? From what time are you permitted to recite the Kriya Shema in the morning?
This is page 18.
Yeah, if you go by English numbers.
Right.
Not used to referring it.
No problem. I mean, I still can't find the place.
You see the middle of the page, the Mishnah.
Okay.
See, where it says Masnisa, that means the Mishnah. Yeah. Okay. So it says, "Mimosa Karanishma Bichakris," from what time are we permitted to recite Krishna in the morning, right? So one opinion was Mishayake ben Chelis Lulavan, right? When you can recognize the difference between blue and white.
Blue and white.
Of course, you remember, red, you know, the talus had a thread of blue in the fringes, so that if you could tell the difference between blue and white, of course, we're not talking about artificial light, we're talking about natural light, okay?
Right.
So it means that it's early enough, you could already begin saying Kriya Shema. But Rabbi Eliezer Omer, he disagrees with that, and he says, Ben Chedes Lekarsi. You should be able to tell the difference between
blue and green.
Needless to say, that's much more difficult already to distinguish than blue and white. So that this would be, in other words, a later time in the morning for the beginning. I mean, it's still dark, but there's already enough light that you could tell the difference between these two colors, which are closer to each other. Of course, the Gemara had other things too. All right. Now, then the question is, right, until when?
Third hour.
So, first of all, it said Ad Bonei Sacham, right?
Yeah.
The Mishnah says that you should be finished with it when the sun rises. Literally, when the sun flowers, okay? But in other words, when the sun appears over the horizon, this is the time when you should already be finished with saying Krishna. Now, as we'll learn now in this chapter, this is because this was the opinion of those who were very zealous. But it doesn't mean that it was necessarily the halacha that you must finish by okay. Rabbi Yeshua Meir, Rabbi Yeshua said, Ad Sholosh Shois. Okay? He says that the time for reciting Krishna is through Sholosh Shois. Now, everybody is in agreement over there that he doesn't mean the beginning of the third hour, which, again, if we take our hypothetical, you know, at 6 in the morning would be that only from 6 to 8, but let's say from 6 to 9 that you can do it. Okay, but what do we see? We see already that there is a discrepancy between the time for Kriya Shema
and
the time for Shemoneh Esrei. Understand? So, in other words, for Shemoneh Esrei, they give you an additional hour's time, according to Rabbi Yehuda, whose opinion is quoted over here. Now, naturally, it doesn't mean you have to wait around for it. Although the beginning of the fifth chapter, we'll read about people who made it a practice to sit and meditate for an hour prior to saying Shemoneh Esrei. If we did that, we'd never get out of Kadima.
But there's no law about that says you are permitted to say it until that time, but it doesn't say you couldn't just say it earlier. It doesn't say that you can't
say
it earlier.
Correct. So yeah, I mean, you don't have to wait around that long.
Of course.
Yeah.
Unless you want to wait for the deadline.
All right.
In reverse, is somewhat akin to that, but not exactly on the point. I remember talking to Yehiel Avrahami, one of the teachers at Heritage, who was born in Yemen. He was telling me that in Gadira, where he's from, they would start Shakris at 4 in the morning and daven to healing until Nates Hama.
So that's the meditation, right? Exactly. It's very fitting, you see, in line with the beginning of the first Mishnah in the fifth chapter, which Nils Hashem will come to, not too far distance. Okay? Because I think here in this chapter we'll move a little bit faster.
Okay.
All right. so far we've discussed, as we've seen, first of all, Tfilas HaShachar Kamsos, that according to Chachamim you can say the morning Shemoneh Esrei until noon, and Rabbi Yehuda says that you have time until 4 hours in the morning, and as I say, let's take it, till the completion of the first 4 hours. Right. Okay. How about mincha? So tefillas ha-mincha ad ho'er. All right. The law is, according to the Chachamim, that mincha can be davened until evening. Until evening. Okay? Rabbi Yehuda omer, but Rabbi Yehuda disagrees, and he says, ad plag ha-mincha, which means until halfway through the time of mincha. That is the end of the time for saying mincha. And after that, technically, then you're already in baruch time. Even though, something requires a lot more discussion, we'll get to it in the chapter, okay? When we'll have a chance to talk about it more. All right? Tfilas ha'erev, as far as davening Shemoneh Esrei at night, he says, ein lo keva. For this, we don't have any set time. In other words, you can daven all night long if you want to. Just as we learned in connection with the Kriya Shema, that the entire night is kosher as far as reciting Kriya Shema. Even though there was a disagreement because the Chachamim said only until midnight, and then Rabbi Eliezer said only until the end of the first watch, which would be roughly, let's say, about 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night or something like that, okay? But they had their reasons. I mean, we learned in the first chapter, why did they say that? But the answer is, k'dei l'harchika sodom min havera. Basically, it was in order to keep people far from committing the sin, because if you postpone it, oh, I got time, I got plenty of time, I'll do something else in the meantime, I'll watch TV or take a nap or whatever it may be, okay? So you're liable to fall asleep and you never get around to it, you see. So that's the reason why, even though Rabbi Gamliel said it's kosher until that time, but it doesn't mean that they necessarily approve. As a matter of fact, we had a statement which said, you know, a person comes home from work, goes to daven, goes to learn, and after he's finished davening marif, that's the time to sit down and eat. Okay, of course they weren't talking about daylight saving time, which was non-existent in their days, okay? But under a normal circumstance, you know, where the sun sets at, a normal hour, in that particular case, it makes sense, you see.
And they probably went to sleep quite early in those days, too.
Many people did, there's no question. I mean, if they were up before dark, before dawn, while it was still dark outside, obviously they needed some rest. They worked hard physically, most of them. So, therefore, many of them actually went to bed early. It became fashionable about 50, 60 years ago. Some of my teachers, blessed memory, that they were trying to use sociological and economic explanations, so the business, you want to give a scientific explanation, the background and things like that, that's what is called the historical approach, okay? So, according to them, Rabbi Eliezer represented the country folk.
I see. The rural people.
Right, the rural people. For rural people, they get up early, they go to bed early, etc., etc. So that when he put down these boundaries and said only up until the end of the first watch, for example, he was representing that. But I don't have to tell you. I mean, we don't have to go on that basis. The fact of the matter is that, first of all, we had two criteria, the one that I mentioned, k'dei l'harchika sodom min havera, and the other one is because we said, that in connection with Kriya Shema, we have of Shach B'chol Kamecha, so that therefore Rabbi Eliezer felt that by the time of the end of the first watch, most people had already hit the hay. So I mean, this really would represent the end of Shach B'chol. The Chachamim said, there are a bunch of stay-up places too, they're watching Johnny Carson, or they want to see the 11 o'clock news, whatever it may be. So for them, we say, okay, ad chatzos. Okay, so. Right. All right, anyway, getting back to our.
I have a question.
Yes, certainly.
Now we're talking. Your ad chatzos was, I'm sorry, was Rabbi, it's just right here, by in the first page, Rabbi Huda, Rabbi.
Where?
Ad chatzos was.
Are you talking about the first Mishnah in the beginning of the brachas?
Right.
No, yeah. The Deot represented the Chachamim.
Chachamim.
Right.
Chachamim were about the year 100, 200 A.D.
First of all, I don't use words like A.D.
Common era.
Boom, boom, boom. I refuse to use Goyish terms. C.E. C.E.
Common era.
Yeah, common era. Okay. Yeah, right.
I don't want to be diverted from my main point.
Right.
Which is, how were they able to define Chatzot? How did they know when midnight was?
Aha. Oh, that's a very good question. Okay. The answer is, again, look, they knew enough mathematics to sort of figure out.
Huh? They had astronomy.
Yeah, of course, they had astronomy. They had, I mean, they knew common math, believe me. I mean, it wasn't, that there were a bunch of ignoramuses that only we have the answers, you know. So, again, they went, from sunset until sunrise, and they divided it by 12, and that gave them, and actually at the number 6 point, right, when they reached that point, so they knew, that this was Chatzos Halayla, okay? In other words, that was midnight.
They had water clocks.
They had water clocks.
In Egypt.
Of course they did. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they had different ways of measuring. I mean, the people have been trying to measure time for a long, long time. But, many Chachamim were very adept in astronomy, for example. Shmuel, when he gave the boast, he says that he knows the courses of the stars in heaven, as well as he knows the streets in the Harda, his hometown. So, for him to make a claim like that, obviously he must have studied it. And of course we can tell from other things. I mean, there are references to geometric problems, for example, in Gemara and Sukkah, where they tried to figure out, what if you had not the kind of sukkah that we're used to, but let's say a circular sukkah. How much of a circumference would it have to have and things like that in order to be yotze and things like that. So they were, of course, in medicine, later on in Gemara and Brochas, when we come to the last chapter, we're going to read all kinds of homemade remedies for this and that and so on. If you have this sickness, try this. You have another sickness, try the other thing, and so on and so forth.
I wouldn't laugh at them. I think they might.
In many cases, there was a great deal of validity in what they had to say. No question about that. That we're living in an age of penicillin and this and that. And
that's
so
also a natural.
Yeah, right. No question. But there's a great deal of practical experience that they had, just from observing life. They were sharp people. I mean, we must never underestimate them. After all, they are Chachomim Gedolim,
Look at even a Rambam.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, of course, he was an exception. I mean, but even so,
he wrote a book of Rufus that was destroyed. I understand that they have cures for some of the ailments that would be very valid today.
Probably,
but they burnt them all, and now we have no record of them.
Yeah.
He was a tremendous surgeon and physician.
Oh, there's no question about it. Yes.
Surgeon, astronomer, I don't know what else.
It was everything.
Yeah. And Shmuel, I mentioned, was his son, but Shmuel was also a physician.
Sure.
And, this was something that many rabbis, many Talmidei Chachamim, they liked to study medicine and things like that. So they were able to figure out, in other words, when would be midnight. So in line with that, I'll conclude with one other note appropriate to the Sedra, okay? This week, as we're reading Parsha Bo, right? Okay. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam tells Moshe, right? He says, "Kachatzos halayla ani yotzei b'sof Mitzrayim," right? At about midnight, I shall go out in the midst of Egypt. In other words, to inflict them with the machas b'cheres, the tenth plague. Okay. And then, of course, later on we read, Vayihi Bachzi Halayla Vadashem Hiko Kovacho Beatz Mitzrayim, right? And it came to pass at midnight that, Hashem, smote the firstborn of Egypt. So the question is, why does it say, why did Rabbeinu Shel Olam tell Moshe Kachatzos Halayla at about midnight? Whereas, the Rabbeinu Shalom didn't know when it's midnight. The Rabbeinu Shalom could figure all the times, you see. But, of course, the answer is that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to tell the Egyptians. He was supposed to tell Pharaoh this, you see. And he didn't want to give him a bum steer by telling him at midnight it's going to happen, and they would look at their clocks or whatever it may be, at least with their calculations, and, you know, they would be off. And then they wouldn't believe, you know, that the Rabbeinu Shalom is going to punish them. So therefore it says, Kachatzis Halayla. But Rabbeinu Shalom knows, so it's why he Bachatzi Halayla. So the same thing, I mean, if our Chachomim said, Ad Chatzos, they weren't afraid of the Goyim, but they figured, you know, they could figure out quite accurately when it would be. No question. So, getting back to the end of the Mishnah over here. Alright, so far we've learned then about Shachris, about Mincha, about Tfilas Ha'er, in other words, Marav, Shmanesra. And we say Ein Lo Keva, that it has no fixed time, whatever. And finally it says, V'shel Musafim Kol Hayom. And as far as the Shmanesra of Musaf, you can daven all day long, that one. But Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ad Zayin Shosh. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, only until 7 hours, which would mean either until, let's say, 12 o'clock, if you say only until the beginning, or which would mean until 1 o'clock, if you take all the 7 hours, okay? All right, so this is what it has to say. And